Okay, yeah, thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to actually be physically at PI. And today I want to talk about recent work with one of my former students, Max Riegler, which appeared in September on the archive, Carolian C functions and flat space holographic G flows. That's what the AI Night Cafe thinks about the title of my talk. And that's the outline of the talk. So I'll start with a very general and broad introduction to flat space holography in the Carolian way. So I'm not assuming you know what these words mean necessarily. Then I'm going to review some aspects of holographic C functions in specifically the context of ADS3, CFT2. And of course, if at any point you have questions, just interrupt me. So there's some material that I can omit in case we need to discuss some of the more elementary aspects in more detail. And in the main part, I want to talk about specific Einstein gravity solutions in three dimensions, namely flat space domain walls that can be used to model G flows between a UV fixed point and an R fixed point of a Carolian conformal field theory in two dimensions. And I show you that this C function that we introduce indeed has all the properties of a C function, but it's not a conformal field theory C function, instead it's a BMS3 C function. And in the end, I'll give you an outlook to an alternative C function, a Cassini-Huerta-like C function, but that last part is conjectural. So there we don't have a proof that it's actually a C function. We only have circumstantial evidence. Okay, so let's start with flat space holography. The big question here is, how general is holography? And more specifically, does holography work beyond the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is the best studied and best known implementation of holography? And even more specifically, does holography work in asymptotically flat spacetimes? And if so, how does it work? And any answer to the second question is interesting. If the answer is yes, it works beyond ADS-CFT, well, that's good to know, but then we have to study how does it work. And if it doesn't always work beyond ADS-CFT, it's interesting to find out when does holography work and when does it not work. So either answer is interesting, but we don't know what the answer is. So we don't know if holography always works. And in particular, we don't know how it works precisely in flat spacetimes. And you have two main options. If you're either lazy or want to write lots of papers, you could take the 18,000 papers by Juan and just send, I mean, the 18,000 papers quoting Juan's paper on ADS-CFT and just setting to zero the cosmological constant in all of them and thereby write 18,000 papers on flat space holography. For better or worse, that doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is that this limit is quite often singular. So the simplest example is if you just take the usual asymptotic expansion of asymptotically ADS spacetimes, the so-called Pfeffermann-Gramme expansion, and you naively set to zero the cosmological constant there, you do get a flat spacetime, but it's not the usual asymptotically flat fall-off conditions that you want to impose. So you have to do something else, even in this simple case. And that applies to many other situations. So that's why, even though sometimes taking the limit works, it doesn't automatically work.
When you take the limit in Pfeffermann-Gramme, you don't get something that is like the boundary is not conformally compact, or what do you?
No, you get boundary conditions that are so restrictive that your physical phase space is relatively uninteresting. Okay. So that's the main problem. You do get the flat, you do get flat space times, but not with the fall-off conditions that allow for the black holes or radiative modes that you may want to include in your phase space. So it's a theory that is too boring to be of interest. So the alternative is to start with lambda equal to zero from the beginning without taking any limits, and that's fine. And that's how most of the results were actually obtained in the context of flat space holography. And in some cases, it turns out that when you do this calculation and obtain some results, then in retrospect, you can reconstruct how you should have taken the limit. So often it involves doing some non-trivial rescalings with powers of lambda or doing some gauge transformation that depends on lambda in some way that becomes singular when lambda goes to zero. And then you see how you can obtain this as a limit. And I'll show you one such example in my talk. So these are technically the two main options. The two main approaches are the Carolian and the celestial approach. So the Carolian approach is codimension one holography and the celestial codimension two holography. And you can, at least in four dimensions, translate between these two. So this was shown last year by Laura Donnet and friends, and also by Arjun Bakshi and collaborators. And today, I'm going to focus on the Carolian approach. So if you want to hear my celestial perspective, you would have to come to Harvard next week. But today, I'll stay entirely Carolian. So more specifically, I focus on three bulk dimensions. So I focus on the BMS3 CCFT2 correspondence. So BMS stands for Bondi, Metzner, and Sachs, and van der Burg. So these are the symmetries of asymptotically flat spacetimes. And CCFT stands for Carolian conformal field theory in two dimensions. Okay, so this is what this talk is going to be about. And, you know, if you dream about holography, you can, of course, come up with some wish lists. So we want holography to make useful statements about a variety of things, about symmetries. Symmetries have to match between the bulk theory and the boundary theory. And quite often, this is very constraining. So especially in lower dimensions, you have infinite dimensional symmetries. So they constrain the possibilities, what could be a dual field theory, quite a bit. We want holography to make statements about spectra. So for instance, the linearized spectra should match between gravity side and field theory side, or certain features in the spectrum, like the existence or non-existence of a gap that should be reflected also on the gravity side. And once we have a dual field theory, in some cases it's possible to exploit the symmetries to make a Cardy type of argument to count the microstates of states dual to thermal states. So for instance, black holes or cosmological spacetimes that have a certain horizon and therefore have a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, then it's an interesting question to ask, well, can we understand this entropy microscopically from some field theory argument? And in some cases, this is possible. We also want holography to make statements about quantum information entities like entanglement, in particular entanglement entropy. So in ADS, we have the Ryutake-Nagi proposal or the HRT proposal to calculate entanglement entropy holographically. But if we go beyond ADS-50, it's a fair question to ask, well, can we do something analog and how does it look like? Can we, again, find some RT-like prescription to holographically calculate entanglement entropy? And finally, arguably the most important class of observables are correlation functions. This is what holography has been used for mostly in applications to calculate, for instance, correlation functions of certain observables in strongly coupled systems. And well, also in flat space, we should be able to do something analog to this. So we should be able to calculate correlation functions on the gravity side and then check whether or not they coincide with corresponding correlation functions on the field theory side. And on the next slide, I'll give you one example for each of these types here in this three-dimensional flat space context. So this is the review part of this BMS3 CCFT2 correspondence. So here I'm going to be detailed. I'm not sure how many details you actually want to see, so you can also speed me up if it's becoming too much information. So let me start with symmetries. So the analog of the so-called Brownian no boundary conditions are these boundary conditions here. So these are asymptotically flat space boundary conditions. And they lead to these BMS3 symmetries. So this was found by Glenn Barnich and Geoffrey Compere in 2006. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with asymptotically flat space in four dimensions. Okay, a couple of people. So those of you who are familiar with asymptotically flat space in four dimension will recognize these boundary conditions. So they are similar to four dimensional ones, but differ in some aspects. So a key step here is, again, to go into some adapted coordinate system, like Bondi coordinates. So u is a retarded time, r is a radial coordinate, or the holographic coordinate. This will be also our rg coordinate. And phi is just the angle that parametrizes the celestial one sphere. So in three dimensions, the celestial sphere is just a circle. So we have the usual form that there's an r squared d phi squared term. So in general dimension, this would be the line element of the celestial d minus 2 sphere. Then we have a minus 2 du dr term. There's no dr squared term because of this choice of Bondi gauge. And then there's an order 1 term that captures angular momentum times du d phi. And here's the main difference to four dimensions. There's an order 1 term times du squared. So in four dimensions, you have not order 1, but 1 plus terms that fall off like 1 over r to get things like Schwarzschild black holes. but in three dimensions, you should allow already order one fluctuations here. And then, apart from these terms, there could be further subleading terms, but they will not play a role for our discussion. They are pure gauge and can be changed by gauge transformations that remain small at the boundary. And it's now a simple exercise to show that these boundary conditions are preserved by asymptotic killing vectors of this form. So if you act with the leveration along any of these vector fields on such a metric, you get another metric of that form, not necessarily with the same order one terms and with the same with the same terms to lower order, but it's always going to be of this form. So this is what is called an asymptotic symmetry. And they fall into two classes. They're so-called super translations. These are these generators MN. So they are angle-dependent translations in the retarded time directions. And then there are the super rotations or diffeomorphisms of the sphere. So the important part is just this Fourier prefactor times d phi. So these are just diffeomorphisms that map an S1 to another S1 that is Fourier excited. And if you calculate the Lie bracket algebra of these asymptotic killing vectors, this is what you find. So the super rotations close into so-called Witt algebra. The super translations mutually commute. That's why they're called super translations. And the super rotations and super translations don't commute and give something that on the right-hand side looks like a Witt algebra for the super translations. So this is just the Lie bracket algebra, but there is a canonical realization of the asymptotic symmetries. I'm not going to explain in detail how you obtain this. Many of you know this. And if you don't, well, don't worry. But in such a canonical realization, what can happen is that you get a central extension of this algebra. So these are the terms that I have low-lighted so that you almost can't see them. They do not appear in the Lie bracket algebra, but they can appear in the algebra of the asymptotic charges. And it turns out that this algebra here has up to two different co-cycles. Whether or not the central terms are there depends on the specific theory. So I'm going to focus on Einstein gravity a bit later, and then I'll show you precisely which terms arise. And the key observation that was first made in 2010 by Arjun Bakshi and then more generality in 2014 by Duval, Gibbons, and Horvath is that this algebra is identical to the Carolean conformal algebra in one lower dimension. So if we're in three bulk dimensions as we are here, this would mean that this is the algebra that arises generically in two-dimensional Carolean conformal field theories. And that was the first hint that if there is a dual field theory to flat space Einstein gravity, it has to be a Carolean conformal field theory in two dimensions. All right, so that was the example concerning symmetries. You can also match the linearized spectra. For this, you have to consider a specific theory. Here I chose flat space chiral gravity because, well, it's a theory considered more than a decade ago, and it has some nice features. The linear spectrum on the field theory side is just generated by acting with Virasoro descendants on the vacuum. And you can verify that the procedure that you do here corresponds to acting with some of the asymptotic symmetries on the vacuum state. So you act with the Lie variation along the Ln vector fields, and then you generate linearized excitations of the vacuum, so gravitons in usual jargon, except in three dimensions you don't have gravitational waves in the bulk. So these are so-called boundary gravitons. They are pure gauge in the bulk, but change the physical state at the boundary. And well, you can show that the spectra of these excitations, they match between field theory side and gravity side. More importantly, what you can find is that there's a gap in the spectrum. So you find this on the gravity side. The ground state is just, by declaration, the global Minkowski vacuum. And that turns out to have a negative Virasoro charge. In some units, it's minus k, where k is the gravitational coupling constant. And there is a set of non-perturbative states with horizons, the so-called flat space cosmologies, and they have a non-negative Virasoro central charge. So there's a gap in the spectrum, and that means you should also find a corresponding gap in the spectrum on the field theory side, and that plays an important role for the for the third point, for the microstate counting. Just in case you're unfamiliar with what the states are on the gravity side, so global Minkowski space, well, it's just Minkowski space in this Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, and flat space cosmologies are geometries given by these line elements, labeled by some parameter alpha and the horizon radius R naught. And those are solutions that are locally flat, so they have vanishing Ricci tensor everywhere. Nevertheless, they are globally non-trivial. So there are two ways you can think about them. You can think about them as a limit from three-dimensional black holes, the so-called PDZ black holes, when zooming into the region between the two horizons and then scaling the outer horizon to infinity. Then you get flat space cosmologies. So that's an example where taking the limit actually works. Or you can think about them intrinsically as specific orbifolds of flat space. So they're so-called shifted boost orbifolds.
Anya, sorry, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When you talk about Virasoro charge, so this is not the energy, right?
Well, in this theory, it is in flat space chiral gravity. In Einstein gravity, it would not be, but that's why I picked this theory, because it's a bit simpler.
Okay. So then you have the same kind of physics that you do in ADS, or the ADS.
You have a chiral half of what chiral. You get. Yes,
okay,
yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, yes. Okay, now concerning the third point, you can do a microstate counting a la carte. So that was also found more than a decade ago. So what does this mean? Well, you calculate the thermal entropy of these flat space cosmologies on the gravity side. You just get Bekenstein-Hawking, so area divided by 4g, and the area is just 2 pi times the horizon radius. And on the field theory side, you can use arguments analogous to the ones used by Cardi in the CFD context. So basically use a high-low temperature duality, Kramers-Vanier type of duality, which you can derive from some contracted version of a modular transformation. And the result, well, is written here. So the result on the field theory side is given by 2 pi times the Virasoro weight, HL, times the square root of the BMS central charge divided by 24HM, where HM is the super translation weight of the state whose entropy you want to count. And explicit computation shows that for flat space cosmologies, you get these results for HL, HM, and CM. And if you insert this into this expression here, you find that both results coincide. So that's yet another check of this conjectured correspondence. Holographic entanglement entropy and the field theory result were derived in this paper here together with Max, Ruder, and Arjun. So the difference to ADS-CFT was that also the field theory result was unknown, so we had to first derive it on the field theory side. This can be done using techniques similar to CFT2. So you introduce twist operators, you use uniformization of 2 and 3 point correlation functions, you calculate Rainier entropies at some finite index n, and then you analytically continue, take a limit. And at the end of all this, this is the result you get. So here I show you just the result for entanglement entropy for the vacuum on the plane. And if you're familiar with the CFT2 result, the first term should look familiar to you. So this is the Virasoro center charge divided by 6 times the logarithm of the spatial extent of the entangling region divided by some UV cutoff. But the second term is qualitatively different. So this contains the BMS central charge, CM. And here you have the ratio of the temporal extent over the spatial extent of the entangling region. And the cutoffs appear additively instead of multiplicatively. So this is looks a bit weird at first glance. The fact why this works is because we don't have Lorentz boost invariance in this series. Instead, we have Carroll boost invariance, and one can show that this combination is indeed Carroll boost invariant. So that's why it makes sense. And okay, then you can use, again, some uniformization results to map this result to more general states, for instance, flat space cosmologies or their BMS descendants. I just showed you one other example, the global vacuum on the cylinder. And the point now is that these are the field theory results, but you can do a holographic computation we used Wilson lines, and then Yang, Song, and collaborators used some swing constructions of geodesics to recover this result on the gravity side. So there's also a holographic way to compute entanglement entropy, and it reproduces these results here. All right, last example is correlation functions, in particular stress tensor correlation functions. So you can show that all the stress tensor correlation functions on the gravity side or on the field theory side coincide with the ones on the gravity side. In order to prove this, the most efficient way is to just explicitly calculate that all the two-point functions match. This you can do by hand. And then you can derive both on the field theory side and on the gravity side recursion relations that allow you to construct the endpoint function from the n minus one point function. So this is again analogous to the CFT2 case. And well, the short version of this story is that it works. So all the endpoint correlation functions with arbitrary number of superrotation and supertranslation insertions, they match between gravity side and field theory side. Correlation functions that involve two or more supertranslation insertions, they all always vanish. So they're only non-zero if you have either all superrotations or all superrotations except for one supertranslation. Yeah.
Another question.
For the entanglement entropy, did you provide or study a geometric randomization in terms of some minimal area or maximal area?
Yeah, that's what I, well, didn't discuss in detail, but this swing construction, so minimal area is geodesic in 2 plus 1 dimensions, but it's not a geodesic that hangs just from the boundary. So in the EDS context, you would get something like this. And in the flat space context, well, okay, with a null boundary, so I indicate it like this. So you have some null geodesics hanging inside, and then you connect them like this, and you do some extremization of that construction. So that's the so-called swing construction, because that looks like, well, a swing. I guess if I draw it like this, it looks more like a swing. Sure. Ah, yeah. That's an interesting question. So you can easily, perhaps prematurely, conclude that it doesn't if you try to add entanglement entropies of intervals that are in different Carroll frames. If all of the entanglement entropies are computed in the same Carroll frame, in the Carroll boost frame, then strong subjectivity actually holds. But if you sort of try to add apples and oranges, then it doesn't work, because you can always try to make this as small as possible to get a very large contribution. And if you do this on the wrong side of the inequality of strong subjectivity, then you can apparently violate it. But that means that you're comparing quantities in different Carroll boost frames. So as long as all quantities are calculated in the same boost frame, strong subjectivity holds. That's something you can show. Yeah. But yeah, it is a good question to ask, and it's not so far well presented in the literature. All right. Yeah. So let me just show you a curiosity. Maybe some of you see this. So this is a poster that was prepared by one of my postdocs. I suggested originally to him to provide the 42-point function on the gravity and the field theory side, but it turns out that, you know, mathematics has already troubles simplifying the 7-point function. So what you don't really see on the right-hand side is the full formula. So this is supposed to be some very lengthy expression. The whole point of the poster was actually to hide a magic eye picture in it. So I don't know if some of you can see it. I'm not sure if it's visible here. Let me see. Yeah, I don't know how quick you it is there, actually. So if you stare at this long enough, eventually you see a torus hidden in this picture. Okay, anyway, that was just for curiosity. So let me now, for the rest of the talk, focus on Einstein gravity. So in Einstein gravity, the asymptotic symmetries were first studied by Ashtiger, Bitschak, and Schmidt, though they did not have the central term here. And Banach and Compère derived the central extension in this algebra. So in the context of Einstein gravity, there's no Virasoro central extension, but there is a BMS central extension with some non-zero value for CM. And numerous of the holographic checks and results are based on these BMS symmetries. I've discussed a couple of them on the previous slide. So just to recap, the LN generates superrotations, diff S1, the MN supertranslations, and CM turns out to be 3 over G. So this is the BMS central charge. And at first glance, you should worry about this because CM is dimensionful, so that means its specific value doesn't seem to have any meaning. I can just change it by changing my units. But if CM appears in some dimensionless ratio, you still get meaningful results. So let me give you two examples. The ratio CM over HM, which is precisely the ratio that appeared in the Cardi type of formula, is meaningful for the following reason. You can change CM simply by a change of basis. If I rescale the supertranslations by some factor alpha, I get an alpha here, so then I also have to rescale CM by the same factor of alpha. But that also means that I change the M0 eigenvalue because I'm also rescaling M0, of course, by the same alpha, so I rescale HM. And therefore, this factor alpha that is basis dependent drops out in this ratio. So this result is basis independent. Similarly, if you take a ratio of the UV value of a central charge and the R value, then also this basis-dependent changes completely drop out. And this will be important for our holographic C functions, this kind of ratio. Okay, yeah, so just as a comment, the Virasoro central charge is zero for Einstein gravity, but it is non-zero, for instance, in topologically massive gravity. So there are some theories where you also have the Virasoro central charge switched on. And that's an example where the limit is useful. So let's start with two Virasoro algebras generated by Curley L plus minus. And then you can do an Unione-Wigner contraction of the two Virasoro algebras to get the Carolean conformal algebra. So let's define the superrotations as the difference of the Virasoro generators with some extra minus here. And the supertranslations are a rescaled version of the sum of the Virasoro generators. So you can think of 1 over L as a contraction parameter on the field theory side, and L is just the ADS radius on the gravity side. So since the cosmology constant is supposed to go to zero, this goes to infinity. So as long as L is finite, this is just a mundane change of basis. So you still have two Virasoros. But if L goes to infinity, you obtain precisely this algebra here. And as a bonus, you can now derive what are the central charges CL and CM, assuming you know what C plus and C minus are. So CL turns out to be just the difference of C plus and C minus. Now you understand why this quantity is zero in Einstein gravity. There you have no gravitational anomaly, so C plus and C minus are identical, and that's why CL vanishes. Whereas in topologically massive gravity, there is a gravitational anomaly, so that's why CL is in general non-zero. Another interesting thing happens with CM. If you look at this, CM is just 1 over L times the sum of C plus and C minus. So at first glance, you might conclude that CM goes to zero since we're taking L to infinity. And in general, this would be true unless you also scale C plus and C minus with L. And this precisely happens in Einstein gravity. So C plus and C minus in Einstein gravity are given by 3L over 2G. That's the Brown-Dinot result. So the L precisely cancels and you get 3 over 2G plus 3 over 2G, which gives you this 3 over G here. All right, so in this talk, I'm focusing on Einstein gravity plus a scalar field. So the bulk theory is given by actions of this type. I have the Einstein-Hilbert action. I have kinetic term for the scalar field and also some potential term. All right, good. So yeah, that concludes my summary on flat space holography in the Carolean way in three dimensions. And now I switch gears a little bit and review some aspects of holographic C functions in ADS3 CFT2. Okay? So let's start with the sum logic of C function, which will be the main inspiration for the rest of the talk. Let's take some RG flow from the UV to the IR in some two-dimensional quantum field theory, subject to some standard conditions. So that means we have some coupling constant GI, and they have beta functions. So dot means change under the RG flow of this coupling constant, and this is just how the beta functions are defined. They capture how this coupling constants flow as we move to the infrared. And then Samolodchikov proved that there exists a function C of G that depends on the coupling constants with the following properties. It is monotonic, so C dot of G is non-positive, or equivalently, C of G is non-increasing under dilatations. The second property is that we have saturation at the fixed point, so C dot of G star is equal to zero, where G star means the value that the coupling constants take at the fixed point, either the UV or the IR fixed point. And fixed point is defined, as the condition that all the beta functions vanish at the fixed point. And at the fixed point, we have enhancement of the Poincaré symmetries to Virasoro symmetries, so to CFT2 symmetries. So there's a Virasoro central charge that depends on the fixed point values of the coupling constants. And the third statement is that the value of the C function at the fixed point is identical to the value of the Virasoro central charge at the fixed point. And what this theorem captures is just the physical intuition that we have more degrees of freedom in the UV, and when we integrate out degrees of freedom from the UV by flowing to the IR, we have fewer degrees of freedom. So in any genuine RG flow where the beta functions are not zero identically, we have this strict inequality that the UV value of the central charge is bigger than the IR value of the central charge. And Samolodchikov's proof was not just an existence proof, it was also constructive. He explicitly constructed a C function using the stress tensor and its two-point correlators. But ultimately, there can be infinitely many C functions because we just want to interpolate in a monotonic way between some IR value and some UV value. And of course, there are infinitely many ways how you could do this. So the C function is not, you don't expect there to be a unique C function. There are many possible ways to connect the two fixed points. So therefore, people have looked for alternatives to some logic of C function. And two of them are of particular interest for holography. So one is the domain wall C function introduced by Friedman et al. At the end of the last millennium. So this is a particularly simple C function, but it only works in a holographic context. That's the main drawback. But if we are in a holographic context, it's not much of a drawback. So how does this work? These are some domain wall solutions in ADS3. They are captured by one free function, A of rho. So for rho equals constant, you have just two-dimensional Minkowski space times some constant prefactor. And for this to be asymptotically ADS3 with unit ADS radius, this function has to behave linearly as rho goes to infinity plus subleading terms. And then it's simple to show that rho equals constant slices are Poincaré invariant, and the conformal Killing vectors form CFT2 symmetries. And the holographic domain wall function is then very simple. It's just given by the UV value of the central charge divided by A prime of rho. So the normalization here, you immediately see that it's correct because A prime of rho for rho to infinity is just one. So as required, the rho to infinity value of this C function is just the UV value of the central charge. And the monotonicity property is not completely obvious, but you can prove it using Einstein's equations and reality of the bulk scalar field. I show this in the flat space context a bit later. Okay, so that's one example of a C function that is very explicit and very simple, but it only works in a very specific holographic context of domain walls.
And why? So this is not Samolodchikov?
No, this is not the Samolodchikov C function. This differs. You can, if you plot it, you find it doesn't agree. It differs. It only agrees, at the fixed points, and
interpolation.
It's a monotonic interpolation in both cases.
And they could have plateau in the middle?
Well, in principle, yes. There's no statement. You mean something like this?
Yeah.
I mean, it's conceivable, but typically it doesn't happen, at least for the C functions that...
For example, Monchikov doesn't. That's why I was asking for typically doesn't. But for the domain one also doesn't happen, or...?
Well, I guess you could probably reverse engineer your potential in such a way that... I mean, you want to really have a zero here in the derivative? Yeah, I'm not sure if that's possible.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any examples of that type, but you can make it probably as flat as you like, but that needs some tinkering. So in the ADS context, the precise profile of this domain wall C function depends on the scalar potential that you consider. So you have to do a bit of reverse engineering to find your desired form. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I will have time for that, so I could skip this or discuss this.
We have half an hour, more or less.
So. Okay. No, okay, then I guess it's fine. So this will be important only for the last part of my talk where we conjecture something, but I still wanted to make it clear what it is that we conjecture and why we do it. So the Cassini-Werther C function is a C function that is defined purely on the field theory side. That's its advantage. So other than the domain wall C function. But nevertheless, it's useful in a holographic context because the only quantity it involves is entanglement entropy, and that can be efficiently calculated holographically. Okay, so what's going on here? This is a Minkowski diagram. I've drawn four intervals, A, B, C, D. And there's a very simple identity that you can show. I don't know how you can see it, so I was not able to see this identity by staring at this diagram, but it's simple enough to explicitly show it. So the product of the shortest lines, A times D, is the same as the product of the two middle lines, B times C. So that's this equality here. And since C is larger than A, you can label this as C is lambda times A with lambda bigger than 1. And then this equality tells you that D is lambda times B. Okay, so this is very simple Minkowski geometry. And then the main input by Cassini and Werther was strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy. So the entanglement entropy associated with the interval C plus entanglement entropy associated with the interval B is bigger or equal to the entanglement entropy associated with the intersection plus the entanglement entropy associated with the union. And if you subtract S of A and S of C on both sides, you can rewrite this inequality as S of B minus S of A is bigger or equal to S of lambda B minus S of lambda A. And since lambda is bigger than 1, this is generating the action of a dilatation, and that's precisely what we want for a C function. So we want that it is non-increasing under dilatation. So we make this difference inequality into a differential inequality. So the dimensionless version is L times S prime of L. And the only thing that we can't fix at this stage is what should the number here be. And we fix the number just by adjusting it such that we get the correct UV fixed point value of the C function here. So this is already the end result for the Cassini-Werther C function. The right normalization turns out to be 3. So the Cassini-Werther C function is given as a function of this interval L, and it's just 3L times S prime of L. Okay, so it has all the desired properties. It is monotonic. You can show it has the right fixed point values. And yeah, okay, I don't think I elaborate on this. So that's indeed a C function, different from the previous ones. And now I want to make a connection to the quantum null energy condition, which I'll explain what it is on the next slide. So let's just look again at this inequality. This is the monotonicity of the Cassini-Werther C function. And once you have this inequality, it implies a slightly weaker inequality. So the only difference between the last line and this line is that I replace the Cassini-Werther C function here in the denominator by the fixed point value of the central charge. And since this is larger or equal to this result, if this inequality holds, also this inequality holds, okay? So why is this remarkable, or what is the second inequality? Well, this is the so-called quantum null energy condition evaluated on the ground state. So quantum null energy condition is a local energy condition that is valid still in the quantum theory. So in two dimensions, the left-hand side is 2 pi times the expectation value of the null projection of the stress tensor. So if the right-hand side was zero, this would just be the null energy condition. But other than in the classical theory, where the right-hand side is just zero and the null energy is bounded from below by zero, here we have, in general, a non-zero quantity that is given by first and second variations of entanglement entropy with respect to null deformations of the interval in the same null direction into which you project the left-hand side. So how does this work in practice? You have some entangling region of length L, and it doesn't matter what you choose for L. So in some sense, you have infinitely many inequalities depending on what you choose for L. Then you do a null deformation, say in the outgoing direction. So you calculate null entanglement entropy for an interval where you have a temporal shift of lambda and a spatial shift of L plus lambda. And in the holographic context, that would lead to a deformed RT surface. So then you get entanglement entropy as a function of lambda, and then you can take derivatives and evaluate the right-hand side. And the reason why you have this bizarre-looking combination of second and first derivatives can be understood from the way that boundary conformal transformations or bulk diffeomorphisms act on entanglement entropy. So this was shown by Wall more than a decade ago, that entanglement entropy transforms like an anomalous scalar field in a CFT. And its first derivative is therefore like a U1 current, an anomalous U1 current. And this combination can then be interpreted as a so-called twisted Chugawara construction. If these words doesn't mean anything to you, don't worry. But the main point is that the right-hand side transforms in the same way as the left-hand side, namely with an infinitesimal Schwarzschild derivative. So that's why you have this specific combinations of first and second derivatives.
Can I see the equation in the previous transparency?
This one?
This one above, but below there. Okay, so here what you did is you rewrote that. To go to the next slide.
Ah. Well, it's not that clear how this, how the right-hand side here connects to the last formula. This I'm going to show you now.
Oh, okay, okay, makes sense.
So what you have to do is you just have to boost back into T equals constant slice. So here you have to calculate entanglement entropy for an interval where you change not just have a spatial extent, but also a temporal extent. But if your ground state is boost invariant, which we assume, you can always go back to the rest frame, and then this is the quantity you have to calculate. And then you can replace lambda derivatives by L derivatives. So this expression converts into that expression. And that's exactly the combination we saw in the previous transparency. So the upshot of all this is ground state quantum null energy condition is a necessary condition for monotonicity of the Cassini-Huerta C function. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're looking for some Cassini-Huerta-like C function, it can be a good idea to first consider quantum energy conditions and see what quantum energy conditions of the ground state puts as constraints on possible candidates for Cassini-Huerta type of C functions. So that's the logic that I'm going to use in the very end. And we will only be able to fulfill these necessary conditions, but we will not be able to show that our conjectured C function indeed has all the properties of a C function. Okay. I'm not sure if I get to the very end, but let me now focus on the part where we have, where we know, where we can prove that this is actually a C function. So what I'm going to show you now is a flat space analog of this domain wall C function. Okay. So here, flat space domain walls, they're amazingly simple solutions to Einstein gravity. So I present this in some slightly varied form of Bondi gauge. So we have minus e to the a of r to the u dr plus e to the 2 a of r dx squared. And those are solutions of this Einstein-Klein-Gordon bulk theory. and the R equals constant slices have the right symmetry. So they have a Carolian structure in the sense that there's a 0 times the u squared plus a 0 du dx plus a non-zero term times the x squared, and you can show that the conformal killing vectors that preserve this generate precisely super rotations and super translations. So you get the desired Carolian conformal symmetries or BMS symmetries. These are not vacuum solutions in general. The Ricci tensor has one non-zero component. So in these coordinates, all components vanish except for the R component. So it's an example of a vanishing scale invariant spacetime. And the Einstein-Klein-Gordon equations impose two conditions for this to be a solution. So amazingly, the potential actually has to vanish. This is drastically different from the ADS case where you need a non-trivial potential to support the domain wall. In flat space, this is scaled away with the ADS radius in a sense. So the potential has to be identically zero to support a flat space domain wall. So it's just supported by kinetic energy. And the other condition is that the phi prime squared term has to be equal to minus a double prime. That's the only remaining condition. So for any given choice of phi, you can calculate what is the domain wall profile, or vice versa. If you have a double prime with the right properties so that, you know, the left-hand side is non-negative, then you can construct what your scalar field is. And since we want our solutions to be asymptotically flat, we have to demand that A of R behaves linearly in R, plus a constant term plus subleading terms, and that implies that the scalar field is just a constant plus subleading terms. So this you can just show by solving the Einstein equations. And what this means is that we can translate all the ADS3 domain walls into flat space domain walls. So there's a correspondence between ADS domain walls and flat space domain walls, because this equation here appears also in the ADS domain wall context. So despite the fact that in the ADS you need a potential, you can nevertheless translate each ADS domain wall profile into a corresponding flat space domain wall profile. The function A of R is exactly the same as the function A of rho in the ADS context. So that suggests to define this holographic domain wall function, you take the UV value of the BMS center charge and divide by A prime. And then it's suggestive that this could be a C function for Carolian quantum field theories with BMS 3 invariant UV and IR fixed points. And on this slide, we check whether or not this is true. So first of all, the most important property is monotonicity. Is this the right monotonicity properties? And the answer is yes, assuming the scalar field is real. So bulk unitarity in some sense implies monotonicity because, well, since this has to be non-negative, it implies that a double prime has to be non-positive, and that's the required monotonicity property that this C function has to have. The asymptotic flatness implies that we get the correct UV value, because remember that A had to go to R asymptotically, so A prime is again 1, and therefore by construction we get the correct UV value of the central charge. And moreover, you can show that if the corresponding ADS3 domain walls flows to an IR fixed point, then also the flat space domain wall flows to an IR fixed point. And the ratio of the UV value of the Virasoro charge, central charge, to the IR value of the Virasoro central charge is identical to the corresponding BMS ratio of UV to IR central charges. So that shows that for any genuine RG flow, we have again the result that the value of the BMS central charge in the UV is strictly bigger than the IR value of the BMS central charge.
Daniel, I'm confused by one thing.
Yes.
Sorry, you want to finish the slide first?
No, well, I just want to say that this means we have all the desired properties of a flat space holographic C function. So.
I didn't expect it. The prime for the field phi, what's the derivative there? So you write phi prime.
These are all radial derivatives.
Also for phi?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, and phi, and the radial here is taken to be space-like or null, the radial coordinate?
Well, it's the RG flow direction, but we're looking at line elements of this form here.
Because therefore, you could think of A double prime as a stress tensor. that's essentially what the equality, because you know you're equating two stress tensors there, you might say. So I was wondering whether the A double prime being non-negative, non-positive, is sort of an energy condition for this stress tensor.
Well, in the bulk, for sure. In the boundary theory, I'm not sure if, in which sense to think of A double prime as a stress tensor.
Well, I was thinking that if you do twice derivative in R, you're going to fish the sub-leading piece in the A of R expansion.
Yes.
It's reminiscent of FFM and Gram construction. Because you
it is.
The formal dimension is the right one.
Yeah.
Derivative gives you the stress tensor of the boundary into 3D FFM.
Yeah, I don't know. In ADS, I think the analog statement doesn't work. Does it?
Which statement?
Well, I mean, that the A double prime gives you the boundary stress tensor?
Yeah. I mean, in 3D bulks, the stress tensor appears at order 0 to the 1 if the
yes.
boundary order are square. So the conformal dimension must be 2, right? So it should work. But I'm just saying as an analogy, I don't know whether this is true, but...
Yeah.
Interesting as an equality of stress tensors.
Yeah, you mean that the boundary and bulk stress tensors are related in some way?
Yeah,
yeah that's interesting. I haven't thought about it in this way, actually. So, yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe. Okay. Yeah, that was the conclusion. So, here, just to show you then also a plot, I took a specific example. We took ADS domain wall related to this specific superpotential, which corresponds to a certain mass that is convenient, negative but above the Breitner-Friedmann bound. And its only purpose is that it gives you a very explicit form of this profile function. And it shows you that there can be different cases depending on what this profile function does. So in our case, there are two very distinct behaviors possible in the infrared depending on the sign of alpha. So let's assume first that alpha is positive. Then actually you hit the singularity. There is no IR fixed point because at some point you, this hits a pole or this also hits a singularity. So the RG flow ends in some singularity. But for negative alpha, you can flow all the way from R to plus infinity to R to minus infinity. So you flow to an IR fixed point. That's both true in ADS and in flat space. And near this IR fixed point, you have this expansion. So you get, again, a term that is linear in R, a constant term, and then subleading terms. But the linear term in R is now not normalized to 1, but instead has this prefactor 1 minus 1 over 16 alpha. And you can then actually read off the BMS 3 central charges at the fixed points. And the IR central charge is given by the UV central charge divided by 1 minus 1 over 16 alpha. And since alpha is negative, this is always strictly smaller than the UV value. So let me just plot this, because this is like the picture book version of a C function. So the ultraviolet part is in blue, of course, and the infrared in red. And you see it smoothly interpolates between these two. All right. Okay, so I think I'm essentially out of time, right?
No, we started 5 minutes late.
Okay.
At least 5, even 10 if you want to go.
Well, okay, I don't want to go over time too much. Okay, but then let me tell you this part of the story. So what I told you so far, we know for sure it's a C function because we've shown its monotonicity and it goes to the right fixed point values. What I'm going to show you now is we don't know for sure it's a C function, but we have some circumstantial evidence that it might be. So what we want to construct is another C function that is not just defined in the context of flat space domain walls, so an intrinsically field theoretic definition where we don't necessarily need holography. And inspired by the Cassini-Huerta proposal, we would like to base it on entanglement entropy in some way. And guided by what I told you about the quantum energy conditions, let's start first with quantum energy condition in two-dimensional Corollian field theories. And to set this up, I split the entanglement entropy into a super rotation part, which is the CFT2 part, and the super translation part, which is this weird looking part where we had this ratio of intervals. And what you can show is that for CL non-zero and CM0, there is a quantum energy condition that looks like a chiral half of the quantum null energy condition. So the expectation value of the basically Virasoro stress tensor is bounded from below by the same type of combination that we saw before. Prime now means the derivative with respect to the spatial variation of the entangling region. And for the other case of interest, like theories dual to flat space Einstein gravity, where Cm is non-zero and Cl is zero, there's a similar looking but still slightly different quantum energy condition where we bound the expectation value of the super translation charge. And it's again bounded by some combinations of quadratic first and linear second derivatives of entanglement entropy. But apart from changing SL to SM, SM being this guy, we also have always one temporal derivative of the entanglement entropy. So yeah, the terms look different, but differ in some details. So upshot is quantum energy conditions are at our disposal. So therefore, a Cassini-Huerta-like C function is conceivable. And we can again take the validity of the quantum energy conditions for the ground state as necessary conditions for monotonicity of the C function. So without further ado, here's the proposal for CL not equal to zero and CM equal to zero. This is the postulated Cassini-Huerta-like C function in the BMS 3 context. So it's given by 6 times the interval times S prime L. And as a sanity check, you can verify immediately that this is the correct normalization at the fixed point. And you can also check monotonicity just by acting with one additional derivative on the C function. And then you find this produces precisely this combination here that appeared on the right-hand side of the quantum energy condition. And for the ground state, this is then bounded by zero. So if this is a C function, then it produces, again, the quantum energy condition for the ground state, which is the same feature that we observed for the Cassini-Huerta C function. Similarly, for the other case where Cm is non-zero and Cl is zero, we postulate instead this quantity is a C function, so it's 6 times delta x times s dot m. So again, we replace the index L by m and spatial derivative by time derivative. And again, it's straightforward to show that this leads to the correct normalization at the fixed points, and monotonicity has again the same feature. So if we take the derivative of this proposed C function, we get again precisely the combination that appeared in the quantum energy condition. So the monotonicity of these conjectured C functions yields the ground state quantum energy condition. Okay, let me summarize. So here are some takeaway lessons from this talk. First of all, Carolian approach to flat space holography makes some sharp predictions about symmetries, the spectrum, microstates, entanglement, correlators, and numerous other things. Then in the context of flat space 3D Einstein gravity, you find flat space domain wall solutions, which you can construct from ADS3 domain walls. They are exact solutions, and in flat space without potential, in ADS3 with potential for the scalar field. And we proved that the domain wall C function is a Carolian CFT2 C function with all the right properties. So it has monotonicity, which you can derive from bulk unitarity, and it has the correct fixed point values of the BMS3 central charges. And finally, we conjecture the Cassini-Huerta-like C function. We don't know if it's really a C function, but as a cross-check, we showed that if it is a C function, then it does indeed imply the ground state quantum energy conditions, and it has the correct fixed point values. And just to remind you, all these results are in free bulk dimensions. We do not know how or if all the results generalize to other dimensions. So I'm not sure if I should read this to you. I'm still having fun with ChatGPT. That's the conclusion that it wrote. Actually, it continued much further, which was a pity because that was a perfect ending. As Carolian characters once said, begin at the beginning and go on until you come to the end, then stop. So that would have been a perfect place for stopping, but then it continued with 5 additional paragraphs. Anyway, my own conclusion is that Carolian holography is a lot of fun, and feel free to join. Thanks.
Thank you very much. much, Daniel. Questions?
So, yes. You mentioned that the sub-additivity is broken. The formula doesn't satisfy the sub-additivity.
So, if you evaluate entanglement to be in the same Carroll boost frame, then strong subadditivity holds. It's just broken if you try to compare entanglement entropies calculated in different Carroll boost frames.
So, but when you write down the two C functions, you take the assumptions that either C L vanish or C M vanish. So that's
true. We don't know what happens in the case where both are non-zero. For this, we don't have a proposal.
I see, but if one of them is zero, does it mean that the entanglement entropy will satisfy some strong sub-additivity?
In that case, for sure.
Okay.
In that case, you can prove strong subadditivity because it's a Carroll half of a CFT, essentially. I mean, not quite. One has to be a bit careful. It's a bit deceptive because in a CFT, you would still do null deformations of the interval, but here you do spatial variations of the interval. So there's still slight differences. It's not quite, but it looks very much like a Carroll half of a CFT, and for sure the result for entanglement entropy is just the same that you get in the Carroll half of a CFT.
Right.
But you're still in the Carolian theory, so you still don't have Poincaré invariance of your ground set. You have instead Carroll invariance. So the boosts act differently. That's even true in that sector. Yeah.
Well, what about the other one with CM?
Yeah, as I was saying, so in that case, if you try to add up entanglement entropies that are in different Carroll frames, you can easily construct a counterexample by making delta x as small as possible. And if you do this on sort of the wrong side of the strong subadditivity inequality, then you apparently can violate it. But if you stick always to the same Carroll boost frame, then no such violation is possible.
C function can derive it using the...
Well, I mean, we haven't derived that this is a C function, so we don't know if it's actually a C function. It just seemed... we were just guided by the quantum energy conditions, and we only see that if we define this would be C functions in this way, here and here, then we get as an output the correct quantum energy conditions. But to really test this, we would have to calculate, we either would have to prove that this always has the right monotonicity properties, which we haven't succeeded in doing, or find some counterexample where we have some RG flow from Carolian CFT2 in the UV to some other Carolian CFT2 in the IR, and show just by calculating entangling entropy that this is not actually a C function. But we haven't succeeded with either of these yet.
Another question?
I leave this for your amusement.
If you say that you don't know what's happening higher D, what about the 2D?
Oh.
There is something to say, or there is even a sense of C function and everything? I don't know.
I mean, yeah, in 2D, you would have quantum mechanics at the boundary, like in the SYK model, or its flat space version. So, I don't know what is the analog of C in the first place. I don't know a two-dimensional version of such a statement. I guess you could come up with something like domain walls, but I'm not sure what the C function is on the field theory side. Well, there's no, the field theory is just quantum mechanics in this case. Yes.
I know there's no entanglement.
In flat space, you mean?
In the boundary. Like given some control A on DMS.
Yeah, I would love to know what happens in higher dimensions, but I'm not the best person for going to dimensions bigger than three. So I don't know what happens there. But yeah, it's of course interesting to think about it. I should also say that in four dimensions, the Carolian approach has not been very much developed because there you have, you know, the successful celestial program instead, but that addresses sort of complementary questions. It deals a lot with scattering amplitudes and the infrared behavior, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to questions of, entanglement entropy or black hole microstates, so far I think there are no statements you can make using celestial holography. But now that we know you can translate Carolian into celestial observables, maybe this provides a gateway to address these questions again. I just imagine it's much more complicated because, you know, what helps you in terms of simplicity in three dimensions is not just that it's one lower dimension, it's also that you don't have bulk degrees of freedom, so you don't have gravitational waves, and that helps you in studying the non-perturbative states like flat space cosmologies and I imagine it's just technically much harder in one dimension higher, but it's definitely interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if I can add a comment on that, one hope is that you still have infinite dimensional symmetries, which is not the case for the DS4 CFT3. So there may be in the flat case.
Which is not true for the known implementation of ADS4 CFT3.
For
the known implementation of ADS4 CFT3. You can also arrange ADS4 in such a way that you get infinite dimensional symmetries there.
Yeah, for sure. I'm saying in the traditional.
Yes, true.
So maybe yes, there's something. I mean, you have more power because there's more symmetry, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, one can, I guess you could try and err. So you could try to copy this swing construction, except that it would then be, you know, not geodesics, but some extremal or minimal surfaces that you have to arrange in some way. But the problem here is that I don't know what to compare with. So even if you come up with some swing-like construction, how do we know that this is the right result? We don't know. What is the entanglement entropy in a three-dimensional Carolian field theory? So, that's an interesting question, but yeah. No, we don't know yet what this is. Yeah. Yes.
I have a very naive question. Is it possible to relate this central charge to theorem, you can also consider a normalization group for in the bulk.
Well, in the sense, this is what the domain will do, right? I would say, unless you mean something else, but I would say that this is a bulk RG flow, basically, right?
So maybe I misunderstood. So the central charge here.
Well, it is the central charge both of the boundary theory and of the gravity theory. Of the gravity theory in the sense that it appears in the algebra of the boundary charges of your gravity theory. So, and in this case, you know, you flow from some UV to an IR boundary, which has the same structure. And if you calculate there the asymptotic symmetries, and derive the central charge on the gravity side, you find the IR value of the central charge as a result, not the UV value. So I mean, I guess it depends what you mean precisely by RG flow in the bulk, but I would have claimed that this is it. This domain wall provides you an RG flow in the bulk.
I mean by this RG flow over a three-dimensional three-dimensional.
Well, in three dimensions, we have quantum gravity, right? We don't have a quantum field theory in our context.
On the main cascade space.
I'm not sure I follow. So, I mean, can you, so in an ADS context, what do you mean? So in ADS context, we would also have something similar, right? We have these domain walls, and I guess you can interpret this as an RG flow in the bulk, but it describes, well, by holography, it also describes an RG flow in the boundary theory, so.
All dimensional Minkowski spacetime. Maybe I should consider 4 minus epsilon dimensions.
Then, 4 minus epsilon, okay.
Based on patient fixed point. And you have some, in case of 4 dimension, it should be a theorem. Similarly, if I consider some quantum field theory living on in the three-dimensional bulk,
mm-hmm.
and there should be some monotonical decreasing quantity. And my question is whether you can relate this quantity to the central charge we are discussing.
But you want to have now a standard quantum field theory in the bulk instead of a gravity theory. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's something like a holographic correspondence between a quantum field theory in 3 dimensions and a quantum field theory in 2 dimensions. On general grounds, why should there be? If you have extensivity in both these quantum field theories, then the degrees of freedom won't match, right? So the plain vanilla naive argument is that the reason why holography works is because whereas in the quantum field theory, entropy is extensive, in quantum gravity, it's not extensive, but rather scales like the area, and the area is the same as the volume in one low dimension.
Within the some called subspace and some subgenerate low representation.
Okay, yeah. Maybe. I haven't thought about this. Yeah.
Okay.
Could be, yeah. Thanks.
Okay, so I propose we thank Daniel again.